The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and is intended for informational and educational purposes only, and is made possible thanks to our sponsor, Trimo Pharmaceuticals. Visit resethastudy.com to learn more about their work.
Bias can really get in the way of a lot of different things, and that has actually been my own personal experience.
What is bias? According to Webster's Dictionary, the essential meaning is the tendency to believe that some people and ideas are better than others. That usually results in treating some people unfairly. In this season, we have touched upon the idea that implicit bias, associations made in the unconscious state of mind, can have an effect on a person's pain experience. We know that how a person is perceived in society can contribute to their experience of pain and affect their access to care. But what if it was more specific? Implicit racial bias. It's the tendency for individuals to unknowingly act in a discriminatory way based on their perceptions that have been shaped by experiences. In this episode, we hear from Lauren Cornegay about her personal pain journey and how bias, in its many forms, has affected the way she experiences and approaches pain. Hi, I'm Mel Forrest, and you're listening to The Pain Podcast. This is Lauren Cornegay, founder of Endo Black.
Yes, Lauren Cornegay, and I have endometriosis.
Endometriosis is a disease in which the endometrium, the tissue that lines the inside of the uterus, is present outside of the uterus. This can be very painful for some people. Endo Black is an organization whose mission is to advocate for African American women and women of color affected by endometriosis. Lauren shares her journey with endometriosis and her pain beginnings.
For me, when I first started having my cycle at around 13 years old, I was told that pain was normal. So because of that concept, I just believed that what I was feeling was average. The knee pain, the chest pain, the sharp pains in my back or abdomen pain, or even becoming allergic to different things towards my college years. I wasn't diagnosed until March of 2011, and still I really didn't take that journey very serious. I was 20 or 21 that had never heard about endometriosis, that was in college. I did not care. I wanted to travel and go to Miami and graduate college. So that's really what I was thinking about. However, I will also say that there wasn't enough knowledge from the medical aspect as well, as far as like passing out a pamphlet or just saying this is what you should be expecting in the near future. I didn't take it serious until August of 2011 when I was rushed to the hospital. I ended up having 2 gallons of blood in my abdomen. That was pretty terrifying.
On average, it can take up to 6 to 10 years to be diagnosed with endometriosis because symptoms are often dismissed as just a bad period. But even after diagnosis, managing pain for endometriosis can be difficult due to the many misconceptions that still exist.
I did want to share some misconceptions about endometriosis because everything is changing always, but there are certain things that have not changed for us, and that is that there is no cure for endometriosis. Now, you can alter your diet to help you manage your pain effectively. You can have surgery that may help with it, or you may have certain things that assist with it, but I want everybody to understand that there is no cure for endometriosis. There's a myth that you only have pain when you have your cycle. That is not the case, unfortunately. You will have pain depending on what you're doing in your personal life sporadically. Endometriosis, it has a myth of the most common ages that is affected is 20 through 40. That's a myth because there are women that are 16 that have endometriosis. A myth that surgery and pregnancy or hysterectomies will cure your endometriosis. And unfortunately, that's not the case. However, I will say that do your research on hysterectomies, do your research on pregnancies, because there are some people that don't have to deal with endometriosis anymore after. But there are some people that endometriosis comes back like they're trying to fight them. So you just have to be mindful of it. Make sure that you are making the right decision for yourself. You have to advocate for yourself.
It's not uncommon for people who experience chronic pain to feel unheard or left behind. And pain from endometriosis is no different. Lauren expands on how her experiences have taught her the importance of self-advocacy, especially for African American women.
Even after I was diagnosed in 2011 and my cyst ruptured in August of that year, that is when I started doing more research. I mean, of course, I looked it up after I was diagnosed. I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then after my hospital experience, I just started looking up more information. And I realized it was like a lot of information that was missing, especially when it came to African-American women or women of color.
Endometriosis, already a condition that comes with misconceptions, delayed diagnosis, and lack of information, is only made more prominent for women of color. Implicit bias and disparities in the pain experience for different racial and ethnic groups exists. And Dr. Janelle Letson, pain expert from episode 1, expands on this topic.
So people with chronic pain are resilient. And then on top of that, we know that marginalized groups, there is sort of this extra layer of discrimination of providers who are maybe not taught how to appreciate expressions of pain that might be common or similar across cultures. And so there's both sort of the aspect of just living with pain. You have to advocate for yourself, but then also living with pain as someone who is from a marginalized community, you're advocating both for yourself with your provider, but then with the system as well.
Navigating a system that is already flawed while in pain is only made more difficult when also dealing with systemic factors as well. Finding a support group can help with this process, but Lauren shares why, for her, this was actually quite difficult.
There were support groups via Facebook, I will say that. Those really weren't helpful for me. I went into the support groups. I actually joined several support groups. I've always learned to observe before I just jump in. Before I started asking questions, I just joined the groups to see who was participating in the groups, what type of conversations were happening, is this relevant to what's going on with me? And most of it was relevant to what was going on with me as far as like birth control and things of that nature. However, when it came to finding someone that looked like me, That wasn't a thing.
We touched upon the importance of representation in episode 4. Increasing representation increases awareness. And by increasing awareness, it makes variances in the pain experience along the lines of race, culture, and ethnicity harder to dismiss or ignore.
There's a big difference. I will say that even based off of conversations with individuals about their experience, whether this person is a Black woman or this person is a queer person of color, it's very different for a lot of people. And it's kind of scary, to be honest, because when you go into the hospital, when you go to a doctor, the first thing you think of is, I'm just here because I want to be taken care of. You don't think, oh, well, maybe I should act this way because I'm going to a doctor. Maybe I should dress this way. Maybe I should put my hair this way. Maybe I shouldn't have this type of attitude. You shouldn't worry about it. I feel like I'm going into a job interview and I shouldn't feel like that. I'm going to get healthcare, which are totally two different things. There's a study that took place in like early 1960s that talked about how 40% of African-American women were misdiagnosed because they were being diagnosed with PID, which is pelvic inflammatory disease, versus actual endometriosis. So that right there, the misdiagnosis because of bias can really get in the way of a lot of different things. And that has actually been my own personal experience.
Implicit bias is bias or prejudice that is present but is not consciously held or recognized. Pediatric hematologist Dr. Amar Zaidi from Episode 1 expands on how implicit bias within the healthcare system can affect a person's diagnosis, treatment, and overall pain experience.
What we found time and time again is that bias plays out in an interesting way when we look at clinical communication. When we look at something called talk time, which is how much time the physician spends talking in a physician-patient encounter, we note that physicians who have implicit biases end up spending more time talking and less time listening in rooms where those biases may be coming into play.
Lauren continues to share her experience with implicit bias, endometriosis, and the overall healthcare system.
Going to a medical professional of color, I'll share, in Washington, D.C. I had moved back from South Carolina in 2018, and I had to find an OBGYN. With me, I knew that endometriosis causes UTIs. It's just something that happens, and I think that comes with the territory and knowing your body. So for me, I knew that, and I went to the doctors, and I spoke with the doctor, and I let her know that I have endometriosis. UTIs are common. I believe that I have a UTI. I'm not telling you what to do with your job, but in that sense, that means the first step you're going to take is to do a urine sample to figure out if I have a UTI or not. So the doctor did not listen to me, which was the first problem that I had. She told me that she thought that I had an STD, which is her pushing her bias off on me because of how I looked or because of my age. We'll never really know what it really was. She then proceeded to give me a pelvic exam. I left. I got a call the following week. She told me that I did not have an STD, which is what I knew because I have a UTI, and I tried to tell you that and you did not listen to me. And she said, "You don't have one." I said, "Well, what do I have? What's going on?" She said, "I don't know." Click. We got off the phone. And that was it. And I'm like, my insurance paid you. Plus, I had to do all of these other fees for no apparent reason. You didn't even solve my problem. And now I have a UTI still with no help. So, you know, that just goes to show you that there are situations that happen for women of color or people of color that do not happen for everyone else. And I also want to share that there was actually a statistic that I saw recently. It's JMA Internal Medicine reported that minorities and unemployed people had a 25% longer wait in hospital ER rooms.
25% longer wait time for minorities or those unemployed. It's clear that how a person is perceived by society can affect their pain experience and access to care. Dr. Janelle Litzen expands on this and how even where a person lives can come into play.
So when we think about the impact of structural racism on access to care, we see that neighborhoods that have a higher proportion of Black and Latina people, the pharmacies in those areas will tend to not carry the prescription medications that people need for their pain or that they're prescribed for their pain. There tend to be lower density of pain specialty clinics or pain specialty services like acupuncture or physical therapy. And so it's both kind of within the healthcare system that we see differences in how people are treated, but then also more broadly from these systems and structures that are in place that we see differences in access to care.
Black people actually had to spend nearly 10 more minutes traveling to the hospital. So when you think of it, we don't really think of the zoning situations. We don't think of health equity and how that has a problem. We don't think of unemployment when it comes to all of those things. Those things should not be factors, but they are factors in how much care you receive, regardless if you are someone of color or not. But it does get heightened when you are a person of color.
We hear from Lauren about support systems and the advocacy work she's doing to address bias within the healthcare system when we return from this brief word about our sponsor.
The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and made possible thanks to our sponsor, Tremo Pharmaceuticals.
I think context is really important. It's everything that makes a person who they are that's going to affect how they experience pain.
This is Corey McGregor. She is the head of new products planning at Tremo.
I think that depending on the context, sometimes there may be external social motivations that make you want to brush it off and not admit to it quite as easily.
Corey recognizes that context and social factors can affect a person's pain experience and the way they describe pain.
Distracting, consuming, and I think uncomfortable is an obvious answer, but I think how it inevitably bleeds in and affects your mood and your ability to concentrate and focus and everything else you're trying to do despite the pain.
Pain affects many aspects of a person's life, so I asked Corey if she could wave a magic wand and change one thing about the way someone experiences pain, what would it be?
If I could change anything at all, I'd want to be able to put it in a little box and not let that box affect every other part of a person's life.
If you've been listening to season 3 of the Pain Podcast, then you already know my name is Patrick James Lynch. I'm one of the producers, and I have severe hemophilia A. As someone living with hemophilia and arthritis in my joints, I know firsthand how difficult and debilitating chronic pain can be. I also know the challenges that come with trying to find the right solution for each individual person, which is why I'm excited to share with you the Reset HA study from Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo was founded with the goal of developing and delivering non-opioid pain therapies for people living with pain. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. The study is evaluating an oral non-opioid investigational drug designed to be taken once a day to see if it may potentially help relieve joint pain and improve physical function in people with hemophilic arthropathy, or HA. You may be eligible to participate in this clinical research study if you are between the ages of 12 and 75, have been diagnosed with hemophilia A or hemophilia B, have chronic joint pain in one or more joints, and do not take opioid medication more than 4 days a week. If you are interested in learning more about taking part in the Reset HA study, visit resethastudy.com. That's resethastudy.com to find a study location near you. Reset the way you manage your pain. Visit resethastudy.com today.
A community that gathers around a common shared experience can be essential in life, especially for those in pain. But for Lauren, there was a lack of support for women of color within the endometriosis community.
I even asked at one point in several Facebook groups about African American women being affected by endometriosis, and that really wasn't a good way to go about it, but it wasn't a good response that I received from it.
Recognizing that she wasn't the only African American woman with endometriosis and acknowledging that the healthcare system can be a difficult place for women of color to feel seen or heard, Lauren decided to create her own platform and organization to confront this issue.
So with that, I ended up removing myself from multiple Facebook groups and just creating my own platform.
This organization is known today as Endo Black. Lauren talks about its beginnings and overall mission.
We are a nonprofit that focuses on advocating for African American women and women of color. I started Endo Black because I felt alone. I really did feel alone. I started off as an Instagram page, just posting information about endometriosis, about other Black women with endometriosis, and people just started responding. I was like, hold on, there's a lot of Black people with endometriosis, so we need to figure something out. People started asking questions. People wanted to talk to people. So I realized that is something that was important. We wanted to connect with each other. We wanted to talk about what was going on with our bodies. We wanted to compare. We wanted to figure out how to change our soul food diet to a healthier way of eating. We wanted to figure out what hair products are good for us, depending on the chemicals that are in the hair products. We want to make sure that the beauty that we're using, the skincare products that we're using, are going to be helpful for us, because for those who don't recognize, hormonal acne is actually a symptom of endometriosis as well. So there are certain things that we did not know in 2011 that we know now because of the communication and because of the safe space that we are opening up and we're talking and we're comparing stories and we're sharing information and we're sharing, you know, experiences. That was really why I started it. We have goals of just creating a safe atmosphere for women, creating a sisterly bond with each other, because it goes back to what I was saying about the support groups and them not being supportive. So, you know, it's just really important to make sure that Endo Black is a part of the community and doing what we have to do. Another goal that we have is really just discussing the policies, laws, and regulations that we have in place and how can we put more in place that are going to assist women with endometriosis. We see that the Black maternal rate is incredibly scary. So that's something that we need to talk about. We talk about the non-toxic chemicals or sanitary napkins and how some companies do not expose or share the ingredients. That's something that's actually a policy or law that's being looked at. So we're doing these conversations, we're talking about stuff behind the scenes, but we're also doing things out in the open for people to see, ambassadors programs, mocktails and cocktails, conferences, discussions on CBD within the African American community, all of these things. So that's some of the things that Endo Black does. And that's what our platform is all about.
Lauren absolutely recognizes that advocacy work is essential for change. And to quote chronic illness and disabilities advocate Erica Lupinacci from episode 4,
I don't think that there would be a change without people advocating, because it's just easier to not have to change, and it's easier to just exist and function as you are doing and as the medical system has been for years and years and years.
No one should be left behind in pain. But unfortunately, there are still disparities in access to treatment and care for people of color. As well as advocating for women of color with endometriosis through Endo Black, Lauren talks about her work with Black Women's Health Coalition and how it's addressing these disparities within the overall system.
So I'm a co-founder along with Samantha Dene, April Christina, and Kyla Kinzater. We decided to take this step in creating something because we were tired of hospitals not recognizing or changing the narrative. And for our action items, we have accountability, just holding each other accountable, creating a patient advocacy board, also create the diversity training. And I mean a real diversity training. We have to be inclusive so that people feel connected. And we have, of course, clear communication. Just making sure that we have communication, whether it's websites, newsletters, any publication that states factual things. We have pain management awareness. And then I believe the last one we have is just inclusivity in research. That's the biggest thing. What I mean by research is providing the funding to those places or those companies or those businesses or organizations that are in those spaces to do the research. So those are just our demands that we have. And I do air quotations because we're not demanding it. We're really just asking you to do it for the betterment of the community, but for the betterment of your organization as a hospital as well, because it will make your hospital better. In order for things to change, change behavior has to happen.
And isn't that what we all want? A better system that provides more people with the same equal access to care? By addressing implicit bias and uplifting advocacy organizations that are changing the narrative and holding our systems accountable, we can hopefully begin to diminish disparities in the pain experience. I want to thank Lauren Cornegay for sharing her journey with endometriosis today. And if you're interested in learning more about Lauren or Endo Black, you can visit www.endoblack.org.
If we as hospice nurses are able to assist the patient in controlling their discomfort, pain, and the symptoms such that it allows the patient to spend their time doing the things that bring them joy, that bring meaning to their lives, that is what is meant by quality of life.
We talk pain, death, and the quality of life. Next time, on the Pain Podcast. The Pain Podcast is written and hosted by me, Mel Forrest, produced by Greg Holtzman, edited by Colby Crow, artwork by Ryan Gielen and Christina Newhard, post-production support from Joshua Sterling Bragg, Rob Bradford, Allison Stoney, and Avra Friedman, and executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and presented by Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia, and you can learn more about it by visiting resethastudy.com. And as always, if you like this episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and share the Pain Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mel Forrest, and we'll be back next time with episode 7 of the Pain Pod.